so on time that we can get started with our public comment period. We have currently two people here to address the Budget Committee, and we're expected at least one more, perhaps two more this evening. We'll just work them in as the schedule allows. Brian Popwin.
Good evening. My name is Brian Popwin. I'm a resident of the city of Bend. I work for Commute Options, and I wanted to come and speak to you about transportation, and more specifically, active transportation. Our city needs better biking and walking infrastructure to encourage more healthy active transportation in our city and lower the number of single-occupant vehicles that we currently have in Bend. Spending on walking and biking infrastructure is money well spent. It's cheaper than traditional car-centric projects. It can also move more people through the same space more efficiently. We can also add capacity with the same amount of space. After New York City installed a protected bike lane on Columbus Avenue, for a real world example, cycling increased by 56% within the city. On weekdays, also crashes decreased by a number of 34% and increased transportation safety for everyone in New York City. Also, those who walk and bike have the least impact on our roadways. In other words, it's lower costs for maintenance of these projects overall. We have a lot of people in our town who would love to choose healthy active transportation, but they need better infrastructure in order to do it. Personally, I just came from riding with three different fifth grade classes at Bear Creek Elementary. I teach rules of the road to many students all over Bend, Oregon. And those students want to walk, they want to bike, but they don't have the infrastructure to do it safely. So I encourage you to think about active, healthy transportation within your budget. Thank you for your time. Any questions also?
Having ridden on that bike path in New York, you mentioned it's a huge difference from combat cycling and punching buses out of your way to recreational and, you know, normal folks commuting on bikes. So I completely agree, and that's one of the things that we need to work on more as a city, and then making sure we're connected east and west, and making sure that those major arterial roads are less hazardous for a choice rider that might not be a serious bike commuter, but somebody that just wants to ride their bike to work or around the neighborhood.
Right, making accessible and equitable for our entire community. Thank you.
Oh. Thanks for using an example someplace where there's snow. Very often here. Well, I'm serious. You know, Portland or Santa Barbara, and it's like, how many can we just bike here when it's cold and icy and snowy? You know, and that's a concern. How much money should we spend part-time riders? And you said 34%. Is that crashes involving bikes?
Yeah, car and bicycle-related crashes.
That's amazing.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Lucas Freeman. Tonight I'm representing Bend Bikes. I'm actually on their board. And building on something Brian talked about, capacity, I'm going to pass these handouts out. I know you're maybe in the middle of eating, but if you just take a quick look at it, it really builds on the idea of what Brian was saying as far as how many people can you move efficiently through a limited amount of space? And that's what we're talking about in a budgetary sense. Making do with what you got. Everybody's coming to ask you for things, right? Bend Bikes, no exception. We'd love to lobby for active transportation and ways to get around town that don't necessarily involve a car. It's not, please don't take that to mean that we're anti-car. I drive a car, but I also have a bike, and I think that other people would as well. If there were some investments made by the city, one of the stats that Brian's cited, it was specific to New York City, that was a protected bike lane, and that's an important point that I think, may sometimes get lost. When people can feel safer because they're separated, there's this potential perception out there sometimes in just our culture of Bend that, can we count on people using it if we build it? In other words, if we build it, will it come? There is a bit of a leap of faith with that. You have to decide if growing from, what are we at, about a 2% ridership level to some number greater is going to be worth the investment. Brian talked about some of the return that you can expect on that. But you know, when you think about the fact that, for example, in Philadelphia, they're on Spruce and Pine Streets, after they installed what they're calling a buffered bike lane, which is another way to say a protected bike lane, cycling traffic increased 95%. Another real world example, cold climate, certain times of the year. So again, money well spent. And when we're since we're on the topic of debunking perceptions about cycling in town and everyday riding in town, there is a perception out there that in some quarters that bikes don't necessarily pay their way. Or I should say people who ride bikes around town are getting maybe a free lunch. They're not necessarily paying a gas tax. They're not paying a registration fee or a licensing fee. When I started digging into it, and you probably all won't be surprised because you're on this committee, so you're knowledgeable about all these things, but I was really taken aback to learn that there's this perception that user fees are paying for our roadways isn't necessarily the case in Bend. The street maintenance is made up mostly from the general fund, which is by and large funded by property tax. And gas tax monies and registration and license fees don't really pay too much of our road maintenance fees. So that, again, just to address that, maybe a misperception out there that that people who drive cars are indeed paying their own way by being users and paying certain fees associated with using that mode of transportation. So not to belabor that point too much, but it seems that if you then spin that argument on its head, that bikes aren't necessarily getting a free ride because we are property tax payers in one way, shape, or form or another, whether you're an owner or a renter. Seems to me that asking the group that has the biggest impact on our roadways is from a maintenance standpoint is a pretty appropriate thing to do. So looking at a gas tax, 10 cents a gallon, looking at a studded tire fee, those might be ways to make up some of the difference, because one of the messages I want to leave you with is that Bend Bikes as a group isn't just advocating for bike width. We want our existing roadways to be maintained, and we know there's a big shortfall trying to make up for some years of not investing in that. But we're looking for, in addition to that, when you think about the growth, explosive growth that we're projecting in this town, the number of undergrads that we're going to add to our population, some people might be tempted to think, well, let's expand Century Drive and let's make it five lanes, a turn lane and two lanes each way. Let's do the same for Newport or Franklin or pick your arterial, right? That type of investment, I think, keeps backing us into a corner from a long-term maintenance standpoint. So that's one of the last points that I wanted to leave you with. Any of the stats that we cited, if anybody wants to see those, or use them for any purposes, send me an email and I can give you the website address for that, info@bendbikes.org. So thank you. Any questions?
In New York City, there's 27,000 people per square mile, right? That's off their city website right here. So in terms of how you, the only thing, because I love the idea of bikes, I'm all for it, but our streets are really falling apart. So. Is it really fair to use New York as a comparison when you have 27,000 people per square mile and we have 80,000 people spread over? I mean, we have to have the density. So a targeted investment in New York City can put 40, 50,000, 60,000 people within a couple block radius on this arterial, whereas the way that our city was built, and that was a city built prior to the automobile, right? So how do we balance a city built without automobiles and spaced out in that fashion with making those kind of large investments given the deteriorating, you know.
It's a balancing act, and I'm not going to pretend that I wouldn't make different choices maybe than folks on this committee would in recommending to city councils. But at the end of the day, it has to be a conscious choice. What are you going to emphasize? What's your vision for the city? And will we perennially be in this cycle of trying to outbuild the amount of car traffic that we have encouraged by adding more car capacity? Whether that's, I'll cite a small example. Having grown up in Southern California, and I know that's probably taboo to say, but I saw the 405 freeway going from the suburbs where I live into Los Angeles go from six lanes to, gosh darn near, double that. And yet, at 3 in the morning on a weekday, that highway is full, north and southbound. So, it becomes, in a way, a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you add the capacity, then you're going to add more cars. If you add more capacity to allow for more walking, more biking, that's going to happen. It's definitely a situation where, if you can imagine, if there was no clean road that connected Bend to Redmond, how many people would venture between it? It's long enough, it might be a bumpy enough road that people would be discouraged. There would be a lot of traffic. So the thinking might be, let's not build a road. There's not a lot of usage. There's not a lot of exchange between Bend and Redmond. But that's because that lifeblood passageway isn't there. And I think the same is true for bicycles.
So you won't be signing on to my East Side Bypass initiative again?
The East Side
Bypass? I want a major loop on the east side of Bend.
And the
I like doing it in town.
What, and so
for
what
a road?
Oh, which is a 50-year planning horizon.
You're not the only one.
Yeah.
I'll go with you on that.
Yeah, but don't we already have that in the form of 27th Street?
But like, separate, way more.
Separate and save bike things. And can I just, Casey's got an excellent point, but I think what you really are seeing from Casey's point is just how far behind the whole country is in building infrastructure for bikes. But, there are amazing examples, and that's one of them. The other example is in Portland, where they can statistically show that they've been able to not build a bridge because they've got so many bikes going over one of the bridges that they already have.
Right.
And, that's every time I go to Portland, I think, how do they build bridges? We can't even afford roads. So somewhere I think we can find examples that are useful. Boulder, some combination of Boulder and New York City and Santa Barbara and Portland that are useful to us, but I think we need the goal of doing more bike things. We want to get people healthier, and especially, I really do, I think the kids want to ride, and I think the parents don't want to let them, because the parents are so overprotective now, they won't even let them go outside and play, blah, 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 blah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. That's about it.
Thank you.
Sure.
We are expecting Scott Baycock from COIC to be here later to address the budget committee, and so we will work him in as the evening schedule allows. And so, trying to remain on schedule, we're going to move into community and economic development continued, part due, and we're going to start with, I believe, affordable housing with Jim Long.
So I will, I'll start with the financial overview, and I'll do, we'll talk about the CDBG fund and then the next tab, the Affordable Housing Fund, since those two programs are so closely connected. And then I'll turn it over to Jim to walk through his presentation. So we're in the purple section, CDBG, which for, the citizen members that may not be familiar with CDBG, that stands for Community Development Block Grant. And those are grants that we get from HUD, the Housing Department of Housing and Urban Development. So the CDBG fund is used to account for those HUD grants. Jim has an annual action plan that's adopted by council and includes funding for eligible housing and community development activities. There's one, Jim Long is the affordable housing manager, and his time is split between being charged to the CDBG fund and the affordable housing fund. And then there's some additional staff support, but no new staffing requested in these budgets. I will point out on the CDBG fund that there's limited grant funding available for administration costs. So you do see there is a the interfund transfer, the last revenue of $50,000 per year. That's an operational subsidy from the Affordable Housing Fund to cover the admin administrative costs of this program that are not covered by grant revenues. So you can see the majority of their revenues are the intergovernmental, which is grant revenues. The general fund loan, that is just a year-end loan, if necessary, to cover the timing difference of their programs being grant reimbursed, so it's on a reimbursement basis. So they spend the money, and then they have to request reimbursement from HUD. So there's a timing difference there that sometimes when it spans the end of the fiscal year, they need just an overnight loan from the general fund, consistent with airport we talked about last night, where they have the grant reimbursements. And then loan repayments, you can see that's about $218,000 a year. And part of the CDBG program, they have revolving loans that go out to those in the community that meet certain income criteria. And when those loans get repaid, they come back into this fund as program income and are eligible to get reimbursed back out. And then the expenditure side, I mean, I talked about the personnel, the materials and services, that's almost 100% of that is their program expenditures, loaning and granting that money out in the community. And then you can see the interfund loan repayment of the prior year's general fund loan. So any questions? Jim will get into detail on some of the projects.
So intergovernmental revenues means from HUD?
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you.
You'll see that terminology in all of the funds, and that just means the intergovernmental means it's grant revenues.
The county, right?
Yeah.
Yes. County.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks. Any other government agency?
Thank you.
And then if you flip to the next tab, the affordable housing program. This fund has two main revenue sources, the affordable housing fee, which Jim will talk about in his presentation, but that's a fee of 1/5 of 1% that's based on, calculated based on the building permit valuation as assessed by the building department and community development. And then the loan repayments of almost $1 million a year. They have a revolving loan program and affordable housing as well. So as those loans get repaid, that revenue comes back in and is available to get dispersed out to other agencies and projects in the community. And again, the bulk of their materials and services is program expenses. $2 million of the $2,000,001,773, so almost all of it. Any questions on the budgets?
The second to last page of the CDBG tab has the history of the federal and state loans, grants.
So those are under the effectiveness measures.
Yeah.
Is that what you're looking at? So that is actually, and Jim actually talks about this in his presentation. So this is not the history of our grant revenues. This is how much leverage the projects, how am I saying this?
You're doing correct.
Okay.
Well, how much you leverage, right, you don't know until the projects come in, but leverage will be per year.
Thanks.
And he's got, Jim has some details of that in his presentation as well. Okay. And it's the down button.
So I'm here to talk to you a little bit about our CDBG and obviously the affordable housing program. I've been with the city for about 10 years doing this, about since the city became an entitlement community for CDBG. I'll start by giving you the bad news and then we'll go to the good news. If you're looking at buying a house in Bend, your income better be at a minimum around 120 to 130% area median income. If you're looking at buying a newly constructed house in Bend, you have to be at 150% area median income, and that's if you have 5% down and you can get a 5% loan. The newly constructed houses are selling for about $361,000 is the median price, and somebody at 100% median income can't buy those. Well, they can if they have $100,000 to put down. So that's those are grim numbers. And as I say, those are grim numbers. Here's the worst grim numbers. If you're a renter, and these are Deschutes County numbers. I couldn't get them broke down enough for Ben. This is from Oregon Housing and Community Services. If you're at 30% area median income, 89% of the households in Deschutes County at that are paying over half of their income for their housing costs. The folks at 50%, 77% of those are paying over half of their income for housing costs. And even those folks up at 80%, you're still at 66% of those folks are paying over half of their income, those households, for their housing costs. Now that's county numbers. I suspect that Bend's are worse. I would probably guarantee they're worse since we have the highest priced housing in the county. But those are numbers you need to really think about, you know, as we're going forward here. We've got a big problem. Yes, ma'am.
And as a form of background here, area median means Deschutes County?
Correct. It's the area median income, it's called Bend MSA, Bend Metropolitan Statistical Area, but it is for all of Deschutes County. It covers that. That's $59,400 for a family of four.
Yeah, thank you.
So the $150,000, you got to be, to get that house, you got to be making around $81,000 for a family of four.
Right.
And that farthest bar, those folks are making.
Those are
35?
At 80%, yeah, about $45,000 a year.
45?
About 45. Yeah, right up in that area. For a family of four.
60%?
For those at the 30% for a family of four, that's about $17,000 per year income.
And 66% of people making $35,000, which is like starting teacher salary,
right,
are rent burdened.
Rent
more
burdened
than 50%.
Correct.
Thank you.
As you guys know, our rental vacancy rate.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Don't shoot the messenger.
So, yeah. Well, I just want you need to understand we've got a housing. It's a crisis. You can't say it any other way. We don't have a lot of resources to fight this. You know, one of the biggest, of course, is our community development block grant. We've been, like I said, an entitlement community since 2004 is the first year we received funding. We never really put any money out until 2005. We've leveraged, like you see there, an additional $17 million, which means that people that came in with projects, we were part of the funding that it leveraged that additional funding into the town for those projects. CDBG is a flexible program in an inflexible way. You can use it for such activities as home ownership, acquisition of rental housing. We can do public facilities like we've done in HUD language. A public facility can be a homeless shelter. They don't consider that housing. Or we've helped Ben's Community Center. We've helped volunteers in medicine. You know, we also do some public services. We've done helped out with council. We're limited to a certain percentage of our CDBG funds. 15% per year can go to projects like that. We've helped out Habitat with down payment and all that. What you can't do with CDBG is new construction. There's a federal moratorium. We cannot do new construction. However, we can do land acquisition for projects, and we can do infrastructure improvements for projects. So that's why a typical affordable housing project is going to have anywhere from 5 to 9 funding sources, and usually we're just one piece of it with the CDBG fund. Our developers get very good at it. I get very good at helping them, steering them the right way. We find additional money to do that. This is our big one. This is the one that gives us a reputation throughout the state of Oregon. Our affordable housing fee was initiated in 2006. At that time, it was a third of 1% of building permit valuation. In 2014, it was reduced to a fifth of 1% of permit valuation. We're capitalized at about $7 million. But when you see that, you need to understand that we've probably loaned out closer to $11 million. Just because a lot of the loans we do are short-term construction financing loans. Particularly, we've done that on numerous single-family homes. And by that, I mean that we would loan the funding to the contractor at 0% deferred interest. And then the only thing the owner needs to take out, because usually we have the land purchased through some other program, is they just have to do the takeout financing on that. What that really does, if any of you have ever been in the development business, you know that construction financing is the most expensive financing you can get out there. Even if you've got a great relationship with your bank, you're not going to get it at better than 14 to 15%. When we loan it out at zero and defer those payments, we take anywhere, depending upon the course of construction time, from $17,000 to $25,000 out of the cost of a house. So we have done in the last, oh, I'd say 3 years, probably 30 homes with this, where we've got people into those homes for anywhere from $140,000 to $175,000, which, you know, you're not going to beat that anywhere. And some of the methods we've done to do that, of course, is, you know, we've had other grant programs that we've utilized to purchase the land, and so they will assume the cost of the land as a soft second, which means that the bank will consider that part of the down payment, which means we can get them over that 20%, so they don't have to pay mortgage insurance. It's just all the different tricks you have to do to get a project affordable, and it's the same with multifamily. And this is where it's the biggest. You see that leverage amount in the 52.5 for state and federal funding and the 9.5 in private equity, private funding. If you're applying for, housing tax credits, which is one of the largest affordable housing programs out there, if you can show in your application that you have a local commitment of non-federal funds, you score so much higher than anybody else. When I go to conferences around the state and I see other people that, you know, do the same projects like I do, I will tell everybody in that room that I'm in competition with them to get the most money I can into bid. And the reason that we beat everybody is because of this. And, you know, thank you, council, and thank you, past council, who was there when this was initiated. It's been an incredible program. That is, that's not uncommon, though, for local affordable housing fund programs to leverage that much nationwide. But again, we're the only ones that have it in Oregon. We're the only ones that ever will have it in Oregon. The legislature preempted anybody else from doing that, but we're grandfathered in. So it's a great program.
Jim, before you switch slides, explain the reduction to 0.2 of 1% in 2014. I don't remember making that policy decision.
I think that was
before you.
It was council made that decision at the time of the request of the local builders. I think that was just kind of a trade-off to get their support to keep the program going.
And what year was that policy decision made, you recall?
It was 2014 when we reauthorized it.
I think it was 12.
You sure?
Yeah, I started in January 2013.
It must have been 12. It couldn't have been 14.
The reason I'm asking that question is, in the face of such a glaring problem, why would we ever want to reduce the amount of money that we're channeling towards our housing, affordable housing, by taking it from 1/3 of 1% to 0.2 of 1%.
That's a policy decision at council level.
Good thing all the policy people are here, huh?
Well, yes. That's why I'm asking the question, because I don't ever remember making that policy decision. So,
we'll find the history on it. I think it was 2012. I think it was.
Yeah, it was before.
I would encourage you to look at that.
Well, thank you, Jim, for bringing that up.
I think we will all be encouraged.
That's a council policy decision. That's not, I'm not going to that level.
Yeah, I wish Andy High were here to explain himself. So.
Well, it's a charge on all building permits, charge on all construction.
Right.
You do a $200,000 building permit, you get to pay $400. Mm-hmm. It is affordable housing fee.
Right.
And the private sector, which is there to make profits, wouldn't think that that $400 was such a social engineering program would be suitable use of their money.
Well, I can only imagine that during the recession and the downturn that there would be pressure to
be more of an argument
to make this decision. But now, clearly, that we're in a different time, I would suggest the opposite.
It was quite a big concern, obviously, to the builders because, as Jim said, on a statewide level, they lobbied the legislature to get around it, to preclude cities from doing this.
Don't we just hit that?
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
It was 2011. Feel comfortable. Time flew.
Well, I would just suggest to the rest of council that we would want to take a look at this again. So.
Okay, that's it.
Thanks, John.
Joe?
Thanks, Jim.
Can you give me an idea of what the breakdown is of the projects you funded, what are our rental homes versus helping people buy rock tiles?
I would probably say if you go number of units, go number of units or dollar, but either way, probably equate to about the same. Probably 75-25 rental, maybe even higher. It's the majority of it have been rental projects.
Is that your preference, or is that just?
I think that's what comes in the door. We have the Affordable Housing Advisory Committee, which is a council committee, looks at all the applications, and they make the recommendations to council as final approval of applications. But I think it's the committee's preference. They understand what the need is out there. I mean, it's, you know, I would, in the best of all possible worlds, I'd love for everybody to own their home. I also know that in this environment we're in, we need more rental housing. I don't know if you guys know the vacancy rate. I mean, like right now the last number is 0.3%.
Yeah, 0.3%.
Which would be equate to maybe 12 units available at any one time in town to look at for rent, which is basically zero.
But affordable housing projects can be rental projects as well as
well, the majority of them are.
Yeah, exactly. Rental. Or versus just to own projects.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's what we were saying. Probably 75% of our funding and the number of units have been rental projects. Mm-hmm. Housing Works has been a big recipient. Some other groups, such as Discovery Park Lodge or Mountain Laurel Lodge, that's the middle one down there, that's done by Pacific Crest Affordable Housing, John Gilbert and Rob Roy. Mm-hmm. That's a senior assisted living. Or Central Oregon Veterans Outreach, we've done a lot of projects with them with this, and they've got some nice multifamily units going now too.
To be specific, Eric, can we offer some sort of work session to Jim in the near future here where we could get together and, as a council, discuss the possibility of adjusting this fee?
Sure. I'm assuming there's four of you that want to do that based on the actions, or four of you that want
to
bring it back to council.
I mean, I'd like to probably, beyond this, there are probably some additional strategies that might get at this as well. So if there's something else that happens.
Well, I think just for you to yes. bring up as a discussion, that's all yes. I'm looking for, not necessarily
yes.
this. Okay.
Yes. Thank you.
So according to your slide here, did you would be correct to say that the $7 million has brought in an additional $62 million?
That is very correct.
So it's approximately a factor of 10.
It is approximately a factor of 10. Nationwide, it's usually a factor of 8.5 to 9. If you talk to other places, we're just a little bit luckier, better.
So in other words, if this had nothing to do with affordable housing or anything that was good for town, it would still be a good investment if it were about bringing trucks of gravel into town.
Well, the majority of the funding has gone to new construction projects with the affordable housing fee. That it is, at one point in the economic downturn, COBA said that the city of Bend was the largest construction lender in the city. We kept lots of contractors employed, kept lots of, you know, of their employees in town. We do lots of, you know, it's local builders, suppliers, realtors, title companies.
Did you tell them that they tried to bite the hand that fed them when they wanted to decrease?
Oh, no, no.
It's their own hand. They're the ones that are paying.
Yeah, right.
So, I mean, you know, I think on this, I wouldn't get too excited about those proportions. I want to see what the amount of money is over time, historically, if the overall budget is on an upward trajectory. And,
we have
We can provide that.
Yeah.
We can dig that up. We'll definitely bring that back for a work session. You guys can discuss that idea.
Yeah, and just to stick up for the builders here real quick, didn't when we were on our orientation tour, didn't we go to a project that they funded themselves up there by Avion's office on Peril?
No, that was all funded through the city.
But weren't they a big part of it? Wasn't
well, they were the developer on that.
Yeah, right.
They were the developer.
Right. So, you know, it isn't like Andy's on the affordable housing. And
correct. Oh no, their nonprofit arm is a great developer. They've done some wonderful projects with us.
Right.
Yeah, don't knock the builders. They've been helpful, and you know, they also understood that they've been, you know, back to let's look at some of the, you know, recent stuff we've done, like the density bonus or the cottage code and all. You know, COBO was behind that. You know, there's I in no way am going to take a shot. We're one of the. Even at the state of Oregon, they always look and they're kind of in awe of the fact that the city actually gets along with the builders on affordable housing. In most communities, that is not the case. And we actually have a really good relationship with the local builders, and they've been real helpful. So.
Yeah, and it's not my intention to impugn Andy High here, especially since he's... No, but listen, I mean, here's the deal, which is, if you look at these numbers... And we all express that there is a clear, glaring problem here. This is an easy way to send a message and to put feet on the ground towards increasing affordable housing in our community. And so, irrespective of whatever else that's before us, this is a very simple action that we could take. And, if Andy wants to be a part of that discussion, then I welcome that, okay?
And to my point, you know, if this weren't something that was good for the community, it'd still be a pretty good investment. But the fact that it is makes it all the more important. And I think, you know, it would be worth doing it even if it were costing us something. But it's actually the opposite.
Yeah, and as Jim points out, we're talking about a leverage X factor here of 10 or more. And so... By all means, we need to address this and address it sooner rather than later, which is why I'm asking for our staff to specifically schedule a work session on it.
Thank you, Jim. And we have Scott from COIC here now. We're going to get him in now.
Thank you very much. Give me just a quick moment. So COIC, the Council of Governments here in Central Oregon, we operate Cascades East Transit. I think most folks know that. And for approximately a year and a half, we were meeting with various partners, including the city, but also St. Charles, OSU, COCC, the Bend Chamber, and others, about different kinds of needs that they had for improving transit service in the community. So we were looking at all those needs, and we were looking at the Bend Transit Plan that was created and finalized in about 2013, and we saw that there was a ton of overlap between what their needs were and what the overall needs were for the community. And so we said, well, let's all talk together. And so starting in November, we began having meetings, and Eric was there participating for the city. Basically, where we're at now is we've identified all the needs, we've identified a slate of improvements. It's going to cost about $1.1 million a year to implement those improvements. And we've identified a little over $300,000 in federal funding. We've already gotten commitments from some of the other partners for about $300,000 in community partner funding. And we have requested about the same amount from the city for a three-year period to make this slate of improvements a reality. We're, like I said, we're so close now. I think it's a really good story in that you've got the potential to not only match city funding with federal funding, but also community partner funding. So a one to two match, I suppose, in total. Don't really have a specific request or anything. I just wanted to give you that update on where we're at. We're hoping that we can announce this in June. And it's a real positive story of community partnership and not going to the public, at least not yet, for taxes and things of that nature. So,
I thought you did have a specific request in this budget cycle.
So,
There is $200,000 that are programmed in, but I think the request is $300,000. So I think when we'll get to transit.
End of the night.
Yeah, about an hour, over an hour and a half or so. And we can have that discussion at that time.
As I guess what I meant, we've never really made an actual formal request. We've just been having several dozen conversations with some of you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you,
Scott.
Thank you.
So, moving on, next on our agenda is business advocacy.
Yes. So the next several funds, there's no presentation. We'll just talk through the budgets in your binder. So the next is the business advocate budget, which is the next tab behind affordable housing. So the business advocacy program, you can see in the revenues, the majority of funding for this program is the $50 business license fee. There is a $75,000 subsidy per year from the general fund, and that's to pay for the payment to EDCO. So there's about $95,000 per year in the budget for EDCO's work, and the general fund pays for about $75,000 of that. There's one full-time, about one and a half FTE in this program, one full-time business advocate, and then some staff support. So that's the personnel services. The materials and services, and Carolyn's here somewhere. Carolyn, our recently appointed economic development director, was the business advocate for a couple of years prior to that. So she's here to answer any questions. The materials and services budget, as I mentioned, there's $95,000 a year for EDCO, and then about $31,000 over the biennium to kind of close out the business recruitment fund that was created in 2011, several years ago, 11 or 12, from some one-time money that was originally about $110,000 set aside from some one-time revenues to put some money back into the community as a business recruitment tool, and there's about $31,000 left of that, so they're planning to spend the rest of that this biennium. And that's
where in the budget do we find data for the exciting new economic development department?
Carolyn's budget is, her department is so large that she doesn't have a separate fund. So her.
In other words, it's a little odd to have the business advocacy program as a.
We'll probably reorganize. Reorganize these funds.
Where's the economic development budget?
So it's Carolyn's salary is split between all of the programs that she will be overseeing. So there's some of her costs are in the airport fund, CDBG, affordable housing,
business advocacy,
borough general fund. Is that everybody? So since that position was just, she's only been in that role for a week, not even a week. We don't know what that program is really going to look like, so we'll kind of evaluate if we want to go back to that full department and have a separate consolidate all of that funding and all of those programs into one fund.
The council approved that in January, that position, so that was a position we took a while back, and then the supplemental budget to support it.
Yeah,
but we'll kind of reorganize the funding of it for the next. It was just too late to
But what is the and so will the so right now the business tax business license fee pays for Carolyn's apartment. So someone's going to replace her. So somebody's going to replace her.
Yeah.
Okay. And but will that still be kept separate apart from this new department?
Yes. So
the business advocacy will be kind of a. We want to keep that. We think that there's really some good success there. As yes.
Okay.
Carolyn.
So I guess there's sort of two parts to the answer to the question. There's one that the business advocates program or budget will come under the economic development budget, and so that new business advocate will report to the economic development director. A lot of the original goals that were set out to create the business advocate position and the BDAB have really not largely been accomplished, but we've really made significant progress towards those original goals. And so what we're really thinking about is, and you will all be participating, and this is not something that I'm going to come and bring to you and ask you for a stamp of approval, but really thinking about what is the next generation of the business advocacy program and how does that fit in. We've had department head switch over in just about every department since we created the business advocacy program. We've had a significant improvement in the economy. We've had a significant improvements in relationships with the business community and the chamber, EDCO very specifically. When we started the business advocacy program, the city's relationship was EDCO. With EDCO was sort of fraying at the edges. And now the new work that we're working on with VisitBend and improving and changing and maturing that relationship with VisitBend. So a lot of the original goals of that business advocacy program have been largely accomplished. I don't want to say that we've ticked every box. So as we think about forming the economic development department and putting the business advocacy program together for the next sort of the next generation, that's what we're working on. But there's no proposal to raise the business license fee. There's no proposal to redirect the business license fees to anything other than that business advocacy, those goals. And we'll continue to update and modernize those business advocacy goals as the needs of the city change and grow. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, well, my general impression is that it was started strictly as an advocacy program. You and I have had this conversation how it's kind of morphed in some ways to kind of like you got more into the kind of like the regulatory part, like the things under the noise ordinance and everything like that. And I would just, if you're going to reorient this in any way, I still want to keep the spirit of advocacy for business rather than just being another part of the city bureaucracy. Do you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean.
crossing.
I know exactly what that, I know that, yes, I think that's one of the things that happen is when you have a city that is as lean as the city has been.
Yeah, you were given a bunch of assignments that were kind
you
of
take on, yeah, you get, and so we've created the policy analyst position, we've created the project manager position in the city manager's office, which was largely a position I think that both John Skidmore and then I behind him wound up in the city because an issue would come up that was related to business, mm-hmm. and then we would be saying, well, we're not just going to continue to band-aids on it, let's solve the real problem. So I think that some of the staffing changes that we've made at the city manager's office and then with the economic development department will allow us to go back to that original advocacy real focus of that program. A lot more communication, a lot more outreach, a lot of communicating into the city what we're hearing from businesses, and less time in City Hall trying to fix policy or get support from department heads to get something done. So that's my vision. We'll hope that plays out that way.
Were you going to say anything more?
The
other thing I wanted to ask about was how the oversight of this event is going.
Do you want to do it with this one, or do you want to do it with the tourism fund?
Tourism's our very next fund.
Let's move on, unless there's any other questions about business advocacy, maybe we can move on to tourism.
I just have this is just curious, as far as the Chamber of Commerce, how does that, are we dues-paying member, how does that
So it's a very unique relationship. Typically, Chambers of Commerce receive significant input from public entities, and our chamber is probably one of the very few, definitely the only one in the state, that does not receive an allocation from its city government or even county government. So they're a complete membership-run organization. All the city does is we pay our membership dues for the chamber.
Okay. So next tab is the tourism fund. And this fund accounts for the portion of the room tax revenues that are dedicated to tourism promotion. So after the rate increase goes into effect June 1, where we'll be levying the full 10.4% increase, or 10.4% rate of transient room tax, the tourism fund will get about 34% of the total TRT revenues. And the majority of the expenses in this fund are just remitting those payments to Visit Bend.
So just, I'm going to just give a quick background so that everyone is operating completely from the same song here. So Visit Bend, historically we had a relationship with Visit Bend where it was sort of a slam dunk where every year we would just give them every dollar of the tourism fund that came in. And it was a little bit convoluted in that we had city councilors sitting on their board, we had staff sitting on their board, and it was a little bit, the perception could have been that the fox was guarding the hen house. Is that how that goes? Maybe, I'm not sure. And so in May of in May of 2014, we approved an allocation $1,600,000 to Visit Bend of tourism funds to do their marketing effort. And then in November of 2014, we radically changed the contract with Visit Bend. And when we changed the contract with Visit Bend, we removed the counselors and the staff from their board, and we sort of council allocated or gave oversight of those funds, the tourism fund, to the city's economic development board. And the goal was that basically Visit Bend would report to the economic development board four times in the year. They would propose their budget in May in time to have city council approval in May, and then they would give three progress reports. So the contract went into place in November. They gave their first update in January. It was a great first conversation where the half of the VDOT were like, okay, so Visit Bend is different from the city. You do a lot of marketing. That's a lot of money. Okay. And they're starting to get to sort of get their feet wet. And the people on the VDOT run million-dollar budgets every day at their firm. So it wasn't. And then we worked with Visit Bend most recently on two efforts. One was a condition of the contract where once we allocate the $1.6 million to Visit Bend that was approved in their business plan, we're allowed to give them an additional 10%. That falls in line with any city budget. So the business license fees, you saw $300,000. If it came in at $310,000, I would have permission to spend, or $330,000, I would have permission to spend that. But once that money came in at $340,000, I'd have to come back to council and ask for permission to spend. So the same thing happens with Visit Bend. Once the tourism funds come in over 1.8 million or 1.79 million, then they need to come back and ask for permission to spend those additional funds. And so that's the first effort that we've just gone through with them, where they came back to the VDEB and they asked for permission to spend an additional 225.24, is what you'll see in your issue summary, fiscal year 14-15 funds. And they told us about where that money was going, how it was consistent with their plan, and how they successfully executed their fiscal year 15 plan. And then the next thing that they did was they came in and they requested the tourism funds for fiscal year 15-16. And so for fiscal year 15-16, they've requested 2,200 something funds. The tourism fund is going to be big this year. I mean, we will soon be talking about $3 million. In a tourism fund. It is significant. Wow. The total tourism fund for just the next fiscal year, all of the transient room tax, will exceed $6 million. So we're talking about a lot of money. And what Visit Bend is proposing to do is, in the next fiscal year, is put over 80% of those dollars into winter and shoulder tourism. They are really saying, we don't need any more summer tourism. It takes care of itself. We're focusing on the winter and shoulder season. So I would say that the oversight has gone reasonably well, considering we're only about six or eight months into it. The VDAB is starting to ask questions like, when do we get to tell council how this is going? and what are we really supposed to be doing here? So I think they're still working through that, but it has been, I think it's been going well. And I think that just the work that I and James and Sharon and Doug LaPlaca did to even figure out what is that $225,000 that they needed to request in conjunction with the new contract was exceptional. We did it really well, and it's a level of oversight of that tourism fund that we really haven't had before. And I think that was the ultimate objective, was that we would really understand that Visit Bend was spending more than they were asking for because of the way that the tourism dollars would come in. And they spend it well. They do great work. It was just sort of a matter of oversight. So I've been really pleased with that.
And that'll come before you on May 20th.
Yeah.
next week, their business plan and recommendation for me to have will be for. Thank you,
Karen. Okay, next tab is the Economic Improvement District, or the EID. For the citizen members that are new, the Economic Improvement District, or EID, is made up of the commercial properties in the downtown core, and they have elected amongst themselves to assess those commercial properties at a rate of 18 cents per square foot of commercial space. And council just approved that resolution last week on May 6th to renew the EID and maintain that in place for the next 3 years. And this fund accounts for the receipt of those revenues, and then we remit payment to the Bend Downtowners. And they have the Bend Downtowners goes through quite a lengthy process. There's a couple of different council actions required to list out the activities and projects that they'll complete with those assessments. And the city is allowed to keep, we retain 5% for administration for, we do all the invoicing, collections, the accounting, budgeting, et cetera. So that's the EID fund.
I should have stayed up. I just have one thing to add. One thing that you should all know with the EID is that, so the tax, the estimated tax revenue is about $150,000 a year, and the downtowners right now are at up an additional $150,000 that they're bringing in. So their budget is about $300,000, and the tax revenue is only half of that. That's not the situation that it was 3 or 5 years ago, so they've made Herculean efforts to really balance out their funding.
Don't tell Chuck I asked this, but is any part of the parking study in this budget? It's all in transportation.
It's split between the parking fund as well as the transportation construction fund. So we have that.
Okay, thanks. All right, next is Borough. So all of the Borough funds are behind the One Borough tab. Borough stands for the Bend Urban Renewal Agency. So the first fund is the Borough General Fund. So this fund is used to account for all of the general urban renewal services that aren't accounted for in one of the two urban renewal areas. We have two urban renewal areas, Juniper Ridge on the north end of town and Murphy Crossing on the south end of town. So the only expenses in the Borough General Fund, you'll see the about $13,000 a year in personnel. That's to pay for a portion of Carolyn as the director. Materials and services, that is, there's $40,000 in 15-16, which is just for consulting for focus on future urban renewal planning. And that other $9,000 to $10,000 is audit expenses. We do have our auditors audit the city and borough. And then the interfund transfers are transfers to Juniper Ridge. Most of that is about $41,000 to the Juniper Ridge Fund, which we'll talk about in a second, to pay for landscaping and some general consulting and accounting. And the funds that are available in this Borough General Fund, we started the biennium with about $400,000, and that's money that was left over when we closed out the downtown urban renewal area back in 2012. When all of that debt was paid off, there were rent revenues and interest earnings, that type of thing, that were left over from the downtown urban renewal area that was rolled into the Borough General Fund. So if you flip a couple of pages, like it's just one page, the Juniper Ridge Construction Fund, as I mentioned, the only activity we're projecting to spend in that fund is about $20,000 a year on landscaping and cleanup out in that area, and then about $20,000 for just general consulting and planning. And since there are no property sale proceeds or other available revenues budgeted in this fund, those landscaping and consulting will be funded by transfers from the Borough General Fund. Then the next page is the Juniper Ridge Debt Service Fund. So that's where the property tax revenues come into the debt service fund to make payments on outstanding debt. And the outstanding debt we have in that fund is some full faith and credit debt from 2008 for the Cooley Road transportation improvements. And then in fall of 2013, we refinanced the line of credit with Bank of the Cascades and converted that to long-term debt. So that's the outstanding debt in that urban renewal area. And then the Murphy Crossing Construction Fund. That fund was just created earlier this fiscal year for the transportation, that's also transportation improvements down in the Murphy Crossing area. We have an agreement with ODOT. They have, we've been able to leverage some dollars with them, and they had some of the JTA funds, $25 million? So ODOT's put up about $25 million for a lot of the work down there, and the city's contribution for the majority of that was a $1.2 million contribution to ODOT, and then we are doing the design and construction in-house on the Peril Murphy roundabout. So that's the $1.3 million that you see in construction and infrastructure costs next fiscal year. And then the Murphy Crossing Debt Service Fund, similar to the Juniper Ridge Fund, the property tax revenues from Murphy Crossing come into the debt service fund to pay the debt, which we just entered into with Bank of the Cascades back in January of this year. And that's 15-year debt. Any questions on Burra?
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay.
Bend Urban Renewal Agency, Juniper Ridge Debt Service Fund.
Uh-huh.
Property taxes. From whom are we getting property taxes?
So the property taxes are levied on all properties within the city, not just the properties in that little area.
They determine the amount based on the property tax value that's created in the urban renewal area. So
I understand.
So it's
Les
Schwab. And
it's one of those line items on my property tax bill.
It's on everybody's property. Yes.
Ends up here.
Right. Yes.
Thank you.
As far as your property tax bill,
it's not going up. It doesn't go up.
It's a confusing way to do it. They're just doing that for purposes of notification. Your actual property, actual individuals and men paying the property taxes pay zero for Juniper Ridge and Murphy Crossing.
So who paid the $2 million?
It's money that comes out of the increment of construction value or built value in the urban renewal district.
So the way it works,
there's a
frozen value. So when the urban renewal area is established, the TAV is frozen, and then it's the increment on top of that.
This is that other kind of economic improvement district, right? They both kind of work the same, where they take the taxes from a
little different from the economic improvement.
It's
okay. That's self-imposed, and the Urban Renewal District Council has the authority to, or the borough.
They keep their own taxes in their own little area.
Correct.
Yeah.
The taxes get sequestered, and they can use that to then service. If they go out and issue debt, and there's an urban renewal plan. We identify projects, infrastructure projects that we would like to build to help encourage development in certain areas.
In those areas. Yeah.
And then the property tax that comes online, instead of going to all the taxing districts, to schools, it goes into the urban renewal
of those areas. Thank you.
And it's called the division of the tax. So when we get to the very, very end of the night and ask you all to approve the budget and approve our tax levies, that's the terminology that you'll see for the urban renewal areas.
Okay.
So in the case of Juniper Ridge, what is the current level of debt?
Let me see if I wrote it down on my notes.
Another way to look at it is we're getting about $900,000 in revenue, and we've got our debt service payment is $600,000, and so there's some capacity there.
Yeah.
About $300,000.
And in terms of, are you asking the debt outstanding?
Yeah.
Let me find my
So, yeah, so the city is getting the $950,000 per year in property tax increment funding, and it's paying out $688,000 in debt service.
Yep.
So there's a bit of margin for additional debt.
$688,000.
I just wondering how much that is.
So the debt outstanding on the 2008 Cooley Road, there's about $2.7 million outstanding, and then about $2.8 on the line of credit that we refinanced last year.
Almost $6 million outstanding.
And the Juniper Ridge Urban Renewal District includes the 600 acres of Juniper Ridge, but then some other area across the street.
The urban renewal area is not just the land of the city.
It's also Lowe's.
There's some land. Well, yes. There's a strip of land along 97 that is in the area.
So there's $6 million in debt, and you're paying it back at $688,000 per year, so sort of like in 10 years, you're done.
Mm-hmm.
One's 20, one's 10.
I'm getting old. I need glasses. So it'll all be paid off in 2027. The line of credit matures in 2023. And the Cooley Road debt from 2008 was 20-year debt, so that it matures in December of 2027.
And so if the borough were to reissue more debt, the capacity is what? Is it the current property tax revenue?
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that we'll be doing is updating both the Juniper Ridge and Murphy Crossing Urban Renewal Plan. Because a lot has changed since those plans were created, and there's a maximum debt capacity that you have for those plans based on a lot of assumptions. I think I want to say for Juniper Ridge it was around $40 million.
Yes, that's what comes to mind.
Something like that.
And
so we'll update those here probably. And again, this is another reason why we wanted to create the economic development district, as we see that there's a lot more opportunities with these urban renewal areas, and we want to. Be a little more active in managing them.
And so as far as Murphy Crossing is concerned, it's done in terms of,
we're about as leveraged as
you borrow the money.
Borrow the money that's coming.
And it's getting paid back by the, at some point there will be a bunch of new construction there, so we'll have a choice of whether to go for more debt and do something else down there or down.
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Question. So, just a quick question. I mean, we're paying the minimum debt service on that?
On Juniper.
And building the reserves?
Are you in Juniper or?
Yes, Juniper Ridge debt service.
Yes.
It builds a reserve by $600,000 or so. Mm-hmm. Why not just pay the debt service down? Are you holding that money in reserve? Because it looks like $600,000 additional is going into the.
Yeah,
that
so
another 18 months of reserve. That's what I was wondering too. It seems like a high reserve.
So in that case, when we'd have to go back and look and see what our annual property tax revenues were when we issued the debt. When we issued the debt, we would have wanted to make sure that we had enough annual property tax revenues to service the debt. Well, the debt has been locked in with fixed payments, but our revenues have been growing over the years, so over time it's going to build up some additional capacity. And I think Eric can correct me if I'm wrong, with that we haven't updated the plan for that area, so we'd want to hold some of that, keep some of that capacity
for
future
other
improvements.
I mean, if there was nothing going on and it was built out, yeah, of course I think we would look to try to pay down that debt quicker, but I'd like to. I mean, that's an area where there's a lot of interest And we have Fred Meyer looking in that area, which is in the urban renewal area.
And that's what I was asking you. Could that be used for, yes. That was kind of the second question, too.
Yeah, you could use it for other funding. I think
rather
that's what
than
we want to
down, just paint
exactly.
Out.
We want to update the urban renewal plan, determine what our priorities. We've got some major infrastructure, sewer, transportation, a lot of things going on.
It seemed like while nothing was going on, we could have paid the debt down, and it's chicken egg. Okay.
What if you sell land, subsequent land? Does that keep, do you keep that reserves, or do you prepay the debt on that? It's,
well, so, you know, we've, just in rough terms, we've had about $9, $10 million in land sales, and that went to pay, so we, because we built other infrastructure that we didn't issue debt for, so that's exactly what we do. We use land sales to pay for any expenses up there. We've been very careful not to have any general fund dollars, any general, you know, taxpayer dollars going to support Juniper Ridge or any of the renewable areas that are self-funded. So land sales definitely helps with that. So if that happens, there is the ability for some of those land sales, depending on the requirements needed to service that land. That's been the challenge with Juniper Ridge, is that, you know, it's not all the lots are shovel ready. There are some that are. So if land sale proceeds come in, that would be a council and kind of borough decision about how to use those proceeds. It could come back into the general fund. There is that option. But it could be that it just gets reinvested in the infrastructure.
Thank you.
Sure.
Any other questions on borough before we switch gears to admin and central services? Okay. So in this case, we're actually going to have Kevin Riper, our assistant city manager of administration. He has a slide he'll go through that talks about staffing. And since the majority of our central services are personnel and staffing, most of our costs are personnel and staffing related, we're going to have Kevin talk about his performance measures first, and then we'll dive into the numbers.
Thanks, Sharon. So just to set the context for administrative services, which is five departments that I work with, and also the city manager's office, the city recorder's office, communications, and the city attorney's office. We, every biennium, we show you comparable cities, and so our one slide today shows total full-time equivalent employees in the central services area, which, as I mentioned, the city manager's office, city recorder's office, communications, city attorney's office, and then purchasing, finance, human resources, IT, and facilities management. So the blue bar in the middle is Bend. We're at about 12.5% of our entire workforce is devoted to central services. And we're about in the middle of the pack. What's interesting about this slide is that on both Tuesday evening and last evening, you heard in other areas of city operations how difficult it is to compare with other cities. City engineer Russ Grayson had this great phrase last night, apples and oranges and grapefruit and peaches. That's not a constraint that affects this slide. Every city has a city manager, every city has a city attorney, every city has a finance department, an HR department, an IT department. So these are really good comparison numbers. Beaverton, we threw in Beaverton this year, which we haven't shown you in prior biennial budgets because it's a comparable city, and they have a strong mayor form of government with a city administrator, not a city manager. The mayor's office in Beaverton has 40 FTEs in it. So
well,
that's
what we need here.
I'm glad you brought that up.
10 of them are just your support staff.
40.
Got it.
So we're about in the middle of the pack, and even though the central services departments have been growing in absolute terms, the rest of the city's workforce has been growing just as fast as we come out of the recession and start to restore FTEs to provide the service levels expected in the community. So that number of 12.5% has not budged very much in the last couple biennial budgets. So that to us is the best overall performance measure. How much of a burden are we putting on the other operating funds, the other operating departments to run the central support operations? Now Sharon's going to go through the individual budgets, and obviously the heads of all those offices are sitting at the table, and the heads of the departments that I work with are also in the room to answer questions after Sharon goes through the numbers.
All right, so now we're into pink. And admin financial services is the first pink tab. So our admin financial services fund is used to account for the city council budget, city manager's office, our volunteer program, communications, HR, finance, and purchasing. About 70% of our admin finance budget is personnel. We have 47 FTE in all of those programs, and the only new staff that's requested is half an FTE in my department in finance, and that's for utility billing and customer service. So we are requesting a new half-time employee, primarily to work in the customer service area. We do have five limited-term employees that were authorized and hired this current fiscal year in 14-15 to help out with our ERP system replacement project. I know council's heard a lot about that for the citizen members that are new. We have a 25-year, our computer operating system is 25 years old. We've been using it since 1990. So we're just started a couple weeks ago. We're in the process of upgrading that, which is going to have a huge impact on finance, HR, and IT staffing. So we have five limited-term employees between finance and HR to help backfill duties when we have staff dedicated to that project for the next couple of years. And that's a three-year, we'll talk about this more in IT, but it's a three-year project. So we've hired staff just for limited on limited-term contracts, knowing we have the need for the next couple of years but don't anticipate them staying on as full-time regular.
Are any of them showing up on this draft?
They should.
So this 12 and a half includes folks that we need just because of this new IT thing.
Okay, thanks. And included in our materials and services budgets, we also have some temp help, $130,000 in the first year of the biennium, $85,000 in the second year. For additional temp help to support, we call it the LEAP project, Leading Effective Applications and Processes, to support staff during LEAP. So for example, in the purchasing budget, they're not anticipating, they don't have a whole entire full-time employee for the next couple of years, but they do have some temp help to backfill. And we have the same in finance. We have some temp help in both our accounting and utility customer service budgets. So other primary materials and services expenditures, for you all, council, you have your dues and subscriptions budget is about $90,000 a year. That's League of Oregon Cities, COCO, the Central Oregon Cities Organization, COIC, and then there's just a couple of thousand of miscellaneous. Other big materials and services expenditures in the finance budget, we have about $220,000 a year for our contract with Ben Mailing. So we outsource all of the utility bill mailing and production services. Ben Mailing does that for us, so that's about $220,000 a year. Our audit fees are about $115,000 a year, and we will be going out for an RFP next year for audit services. And then there's just some general consulting on the finance side. We have our investment advisor contract that will be going to council next week on the 20th. Investment advisors, legal, et cetera. And then in HR, they have some organizational development, training, and their materials and services.
So Sharon, if you would please explain the by-program city council proposed budget of $235,000 or $236,000 roughly.
Okay.
If does that mean that
you're getting a raise?
Well, no.
Percentage.
Only if we're deserving of that. Right? Yeah, but so for example, if staff spends time at a late midnight meeting, do they bill that time to that particular by program?
Yeah, I know.
Right?
Are you offering that up?
I mean, well, wouldn't that be the logical thing to do?
Look back.
None of us are getting paid for that time. It's in our base salary.
The budget breakdowns in the back part of this tab. From the city council and all of the charges to the city council budget.
What page are you on, Jim?
So
it's not numbered, but it's in the back of the path.
And it'll be on, it says City Council Budget by Program at the bottom, and it'll be on your left-hand side of the page.
So we have an editorial comment. We have a city where just the administration and financial services program is $8 million a year. And of that, $16,800 is salaries for city council. I'm not here to claim we're worth more than that, but it does seem pretty weird. And that's set, of course, in the city charter.
So I guess I was just curious how that 236
breaks out.
Yeah, breaks out and
so it's 18,000 is your
again. Where are you reading?
Right there.
Yeah, there
yes.
You go.
You're on the 15-16, right?
So 15-16. Yeah. It's, you know, your $200 a month, and then we do have to pay Social Security and Medicare taxes on that and workers' comp. If you look in your materials and services, the $90,000 is the dues and subscriptions, and I have a handout if you guys want the detail amounts. And then the $52,000 consulting, $42,000 of that is Eric Kanzler's contract, and the other $10,000 is just miscellaneous for other projects that may come up during the year.
Okay,
I have to ask, do we really have no liquor licenses or other business licenses in 2013 that can't be what zero means in that category? We spend no money on those.
Are you in the revenues?
Yeah, we have revenue, liquor license cuts.
I think it used to be, it was in the general fund, right? Yeah.
It used to be, it just got moved.
In the general fund.
Okay. Yes.
It
wasn't that bad.
Any other questions on all of the admin finance programs?
In the personnel services, what else included other than benefits?
It's just salary and benefits, but it's all benefits.
HERS,
health insurance, health, dental, workers' comp,
unemployment,
Social Security, Medicare.
Is that what you're doing? Overtime.
No.
Okay.
So I know that Ann Orand is a service to the council, but as well as to the administrative staff. So I take it that her salary is accounted for somewhere else.
She's in communications.
Okay. Thank you.
And just as a reminder, so you want to do the real brief cost allocation so that is for the new person, how it all works.
So we are not we're not out there charging fees and charges to the community to pay for finance, pay for city manager's office. So all of our costs are supported by the operating departments. So we have a indirect cost allocation plan that we use to allocate and equitably charge all of the departments for city attorney, all of the programs in this fund, IT, facilities, garage, engineering, so Tom's EIPD function, the lab that supports the utilities. And there's the allocation basis varies based on each department, but for example, HR has a couple of different allocation methods, but it's all based on employees. There's a portion of their costs that are allocated to all employees, a portion based to, allocated based on the number of represented employees, a portion based on there's an employee turnover factor, recognizing that that's more work on the HR department when employees leave, recruitments, et cetera. Facilities is based on square footage. IT is based on there's an allocation of number of user IDs, computers, and even the computers is broken down. If it's a desktop, a laptop, a mobile tablet, because there's just different levels of IT infrastructure needed to support the different types of equipment. So we use the same, that methodology is applied consistently across the city, and as the departments have said before, you know, they think it's fair because they all, nobody likes it, so it must be equitable and fair.
but the point is, it's not budget based. In other words, if some department had a huge increase in their budget for a specific program that did not involve hiring more FTEs, their fee to central services would not change.
No, some of it is budget basis. So city manager's office, for example, they're about half and half. Half of it is based on their and it's all based on a look back, I should point out as well. So it's all based on the prior year's actuals and activity. So city manager's office goes through and kind of estimates their actual time and their actual workload. So a portion is based on that, and a portion is based on their actual spending. And same with finance. You know, we've got a couple of different allocation methods for finance, but a portion being based on budget. Same thing with purchasing, because the more contracts you have, the more of
Gwen and her staff. They're sort of fixed, and there's variable for certain types of internal services. So for example, there's what's called kind of special purpose transfers. So if a department wants to buy some software, let's say the police department wants, they have new forensic software they want to buy, IT might manage that, and so they'll transfer money to IT, which is above and beyond. It's equity. There's not other departments paying for that software that only benefits police.
Yeah, and it's audited annually by HUD as well.
A couple of quickies here. Communications program.
Uh-huh.
I saw that the interfund transfers, and you may have said something about this, but if so, I missed it. It's pretty steeply, and I was just trying to understand what might have caused that to be.
So are you looking that on the page that has the increase from the 19,934 to 66,040? Is that where you are?
Actually, I'm on the page, communication program mm-hmm. page that has the breakdown, the interfund transfers.
Yep.
Oh, yes, that's exactly right.
Okay, so as Eric just mentioned, we have a couple of different types of transfers. We have some that are just our, what we call overhead, and then special purpose. So the special purpose transfer is it the council video or audio?
I think so. We're doing some. We've been doing upgrades to our council chambers to have. Is Justin here?
Yeah. It's for the. Currently, we rely on Ben Broadband to broadcast our council meetings, and we pay them for that privilege. So we're proposing to put in our own equipment, A, to better cover the council meetings, so we can the public can see better what's going on. And then we wouldn't pay Ben Broadband anymore, so we recoup that cost eventually.
Okay, that answers that. And then on the human resources program, noticed that was the overall fund is up like 56%. And I see that there's an increase in FTEs mm-hmm. By 20%. And so I figured there was obviously some reason why actually both the personnel services and materials and services were up pretty steeply, 118% for materials and services. And so that's what resulted in a more than 50% increase.
So HR, the 5 FTE for this year, that includes one of those limited term staff that was hired for the LEAP project. So we had one of those employees hired this year, but they weren't onboarded until like halfway through the year. So we had about half a year of vacancies in that. And then we'll talk about this when we get to the next fund, legal and risk management. But our legal and risk management program used to include risk and training, but we transferred the training function and that training FTE from legal to HR. And that increase in the FTE, that transfer, shows up in the, that's your increase from 5 to 6 FTE.
Right.
So we moved the training employee and the associated training costs that shows up in the materials and services from the legal budget to HR. And HR also has some other, we are embarking on a new performance management system. So there's some consulting dollars in the budget.
And that also accounts for the sharp increase in materials and services?
Right, because of those training costs were transferred in from legal.
Okay, got it.
So we have a lot of citywide. So individual departments will have some training costs in their budget. I mean, for the most part, we pay for our own training. But then HR, and Rob can speak to this in more detail, but the city has just launched into a public agency training consortium. So the city, the county, Parks and Rec, the library,
you're doing good.
And who else?
Redmond.
There's a city of Redmond. All five agencies spent, gosh, it must have been almost a year, developing a training program that's coordinated through COCC. COCC set up a really nice website so we can do all of our course class registration online. There's a course catalog, and they're offering classes in the fall and spring. So it looks just like a regular college course catalog, but it has a lot of that citywide training that's now being offered that's paid for out of the HR budget that any city employee can participate in.
Okay. This question might better apply to the risk management discussion that we're about ready to get to, but I noticed in the narrative there that the emergency preparedness planning, or it's been moved out of risk management and apparently moved to
fire. So we have
it said human resources, but apparently that's just the training part.
Just the training part moved to HR from, we had an employee in that was doing risk management, training, and emergency preparedness.
Kurt Chapman?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Is he still here?
Nope, so he left. And so when he moved to Medford and took another position there, so when he vacated his position, we kind of reshuffled some things around, moved the training component to HR, moved the emergency management component to fire. They were better positioned to take on that role, and they formed kind of a team of folks. And the risk part remained in legal, but we're kind of just in the process of evaluating that.
So emergency preparedness planning is I have to confess, one of the reasons why I wanted to be on this committee.
Yeah.
Because I have been trying to get the city to make some progress on its planning, emergency preparedness planning, for 4 or 5 years. And I wasn't seeing much progress when I was working with Kurt. And so I didn't know what was going on, but I see from the budget document that it's no longer in risk management, which is where I thought it was.
Yeah.
And so we've already talked about fire.
Yeah, so Bill Booth, who is here, he is the guy. He was here last night.
Is that you?
No. He was here last night, so I'm happy to put you in touch with Bill, and he can talk about how the
perfect
that program is.
Okay, thanks.
Eric, real quick. Yesterday there was a major exercise the city conducted for the Ashley Eaton Day at Mountain View High School, so we talked about a program getting up to speed. Bill headed that up and went great. It was they used that event as a training exercise for everybody in the city, as well as other agencies.
Bill Booth?
Booth. I'll send you his contact information.
No, thanks.
Thanks.
So I'll move us along so we can stay on track for our deliberations tonight to legal and risk management.
If I may, just 10 seconds here. Neighborhood associations.
Yes.
Thank you.
Something that has been clamoring for additional funding, and I see a 50% increase in that there, and for communication and for solidifying their position within the community.
Correct.
So thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks for bringing that up.
Thank you for, I forgot to mention that. That's reflective of council goals and work plan that I introduced.
Thank you.
And that increases each of their budgets.
Well, it gets them
according to tax laws.
It's according to, there's a formula applied, and we can talk in more detail at some other point. But what we want to do is really, in those that are active, they would have the ability to kind of apply for some of those funds. And
well, just for other counselors, we're taking it by NM from around 200,000 to almost 300,000 now. So
over that 2 years, and then we're also providing some funding to help some training for them as well, to help them become more organized and
more connected, and so we've talked about grouping them so that, you know, we can really be more proactive in getting communication, getting issues identified. That might be area specific, or maybe a couple of neighborhoods have, you know, an issue.
Commonality.
And we want to surface that instead of just these monthly reports to council, where a neighborhood association stands up for a couple of minutes and gives a report, and then we're moving on to the next business item, to be more thoughtful about how we engage with the neighborhood associations and identifying their needs and issues.
Great.
So that's part of those resources to help us do that better.
Great.
Thank you, Doug.
Sorry to interrupt.
That's all right. That's the last one.
I'll be out in the hall.
I'm sorry, totally random. Food. Is all the food we eat, is that all? If it's an affordable housing committee lunch meeting, then it's an affordable housing. If it's transportation, it's in transportation.
The council, so the council meals that you eat for council, and those are in your council
food
budget.
Food and lodging, is that?
That's all in your council budget.
More than our salary.
Oh, a lot more.
So.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
So legal and risk management, we've really already talked about one of the main changes in this fund, and that was the, as we mentioned, the training program moving out of this fund into HR. And on the legal side, they are asking for one new attorney.
It's an Amber Alert.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Not around here.
Amber.
Something's really She's in trouble. She's in trouble. Sinead's traveling right now.
Okay.
So they are asking for one new attorney in the first year of the biennium, so that
sweet.
We're prepared.
And the legal.
I don't know that I'm cool enough to work for Marion.
Oh, yeah.
Might not be.
Sorry, it's been a long week.
Try again another time.
You walked right in
there. Yeah.
I opened the door for her.
Yeah, you did. And as we just mentioned, Mary's budget, as the legal and risk budget, is also funded through the cost allocation plan. And that budget is based on an estimate of actual workload. So the departments requiring more of Mary and Gary's time have a higher allocation of transfers. So any questions on the legal or risk? None. Okay, next tab, IT. IT is also funded.
There it is.
IT is also funded by the through the cost allocation plan, with the exception of the LEAP project, or the ERP system replacement. Back in February, we went to council and got approval for a three-year drawdown facility with Bank of the Cascades to finance the ERP project. And then once the project is complete, we kind of know what our actual spending is going to be. We'll convert that short-term debt into long-term debt for that project. So that's the last line of revenues, issuance of short-term debt. That reflects the estimated drawdowns that we're expecting each year of the biennium. So the IT department has 17 staff, and they are not requesting, there's no new staff requested in the budget. The main project they have going on is our ERP system replacement. You'll notice when up at the top expenditure section where we have requirements by program, enterprise IT, and then department specific IT. Like Eric mentioned, the enterprise IT, that's the amount that's funded through the cost allocation plan.
Sorry. Just keep going until I can get my password in.
And then the department-specific IT, those are projects, software costs, annual maintenance fees on software and projects that benefit a specific department. So we don't want to, you know, if Public Works or Utilities has a large software, say they have a 500,000 software replacement project, we want just that benefiting department to pay for that rather than charging everyone citywide that's not getting the use or benefit. And we can go into more details on some of the other costs, but the majority of their budget is annual maintenance and software contracts, citywide PC replacements. So that is about $200,000 a year. So they IT manages that central PC replacement cost. So they have the replacement schedule for everyone's computer, and that's funded through their department versus every individual department budgeting for, you know, $1,500 every couple of years. It's just easier for them to, they have the citywide inventory and for them to manage that. David?
Did I hear you say that there was no increase in personnel?
They aren't requesting any new staff this biennium, but they, I think they had...
Do you think that's GIS?
It looks like there's a 1.3 approximately increase.
I think that might be... So prior to this biennium, our GIS function, we have two employees that were primarily assigned to GIS in the past, and that program was accounted for separately, and their costs were split. Only a third of their costs were funded out of the citywide enterprise IT budget. The rest was funded, some of it out of GIS, and some from other operating departments. So community development and public works also directly paid for a portion of those costs. And those, we didn't add any new staff, but we brought all of their costs back into IT.
Okay, so net, it's,
yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
So no new people, but the IT department is now picking up the full cost of those staff. And the reason-
We changed the position. So instead of doing GIS mapping, they're really doing data warehousing, really being kind of a central clearinghouse for all the data, and then the departments themselves are mapping based on their needs, so they're not doing, which is more appropriate, it's more kind of the infrastructure needed to do the GIS
work. Yeah, okay.
Thank you, Sharon.
Any other questions on IT? All right.
So that's break time.
Right on schedule.
Right on schedule.
Unbelievable.